Okay, so let's pick up where we left off in Proverbs chapter 22. Let's just get right into it, okay? In verse 1 of chapter 22 of Proverbs, it says, "A good name is to be more desired than a great wealth. Favor is better than silver and gold." Solomon says something, I think, very interesting along those lines when he's in Ecclesiastes, when we went through that book. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7, he said this. He said, "A good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than a day of one's birth." He said, "It's better to go to a house of mourning," or that's actually to a funeral parlor, than to go to a house of feasting or partying, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. And when he said the living takes it to heart, he's talking about the spiritually quickened person will take the reality of death to heart. And he said, "Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. And the mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure." It's better to go into a funeral parlor, sit quietly there, and reflect upon the reality, the fact that we're all going to die someday. And he said that a good name is better than a good ointment. And he also went on to say that the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Why? If you have a good name, in other words, if you develop a reputation of being a good person, I'm talking about a good person in the eyes of God, not a good person in your own eyes, or a good person in your mother's eyes, or a good person in the world's eyes, but a good person as far as God is concerned, then the day of your death is going to be better than the day of your birth. That's what Solomon is talking about. And it's really a good idea to go and reflect upon that very often. But here's the thing. If we have a good name, that's what's to be developed. It says here, a good name is more desirable than great wealth. But look what's happening to us today. I mean, we put so much emphasis upon what? We put all the emphasis, it seems like, goes into the physical rather than the spiritual. I thought it was kind of interesting, you know, one of the latest Newsweek magazines, there was an article there that how much it costs, how much beauty costs. What's your beauty cost? Anyway, you had to log on to the internet to get it, and I was just curious about it, so I did log on. And basically what it was saying is that women, what they spend in their lifetime to look beautiful, they talk about the hair, the face, the body, the hands and the feet for tweens, whatever that age is. I guess it's, what is it, preteens. You know, there's an average spend of $7,170, and from the teens to the 20s, there's $65,865, and from the ages 30 to 40, women spend $158,160, and ages 50 plus is $217,932. Now, a lifetime total comes to $449,127 to look beautiful. Okay. Now, I'm not trying to mock this. I'm just simply saying this is the emphasis. This is the emphasis. Now, granted, I'm sure that this doesn't apply to all women, obviously, but I guess they included everything from, you know, just makeup, lipstick, tummy tucks, surgery, everything that's thrown in there. I guess they're just getting an overall average. But look at the emphasis. Look at the emphasis being put upon, you know, looking good. But Solomon's saying, hey, man, what's really needed is a good name. And a good name before God, that's what he's talking about here. A good name is to be more desired than great wealth, for favor is better than silver and gold. We don't see that today. That's not where our priorities lie. That's not where the emphasis is. It's just not. It's just not in this world. But what's in a name? I mean, it was Peter who says, there's no other name under heaven in which we must be saved, you know, other than the name of Jesus Christ, right? But then we got to ask ourselves, what kind of name do we have? And I'm talking about a name before heaven. I'm not talking about a name before people on earth, because that's what's really, really going to matter in the end. And if we have a good name towards heaven, it's going to be better than a good ointment. And a day of our death is going to be better than a day of our birth. But we got to ask ourselves, I mean, what's involved there? I mean, I remember years ago, driving my car, and I was listening to the radio to a local pastor. As a matter of fact, it was Pastor Glenn Cole. And he said something I'll never forget. I was driving along, and he said that he was called, as basically probably a young pastor, he was called to give a eulogy at a funeral. And he didn't personally know this individual that died, but it was his job as a pastor, so he agreed to do it. And then when he arrived at the funeral parlor, there was no one there except this, you know, deceased man lying in the coffin, and there was the funeral director waiting in the back to take the body to the cemetery when the service was over. So Pastor Cole said that when he's there, he was just waiting and waiting. The hour arrived and nobody was there, so he kept waiting and waiting, and still nobody showed up until it basically dawned on him that nobody's coming to this man's funeral. And so he didn't know what to do. But he figures, well, somebody called me to do this, and they're paying me to do this, so I should do this. So he got up and he gave his eulogy to the undertaker, or to the funeral director, who was patiently waiting in the back to take this body to the cemetery. And he gave his eulogy to the funeral director, and then he left. And he, as he was walking to his car, he just said, thought to himself, what kind of person was this? What kind of man was this? That nobody would bother to take the time to come to pay their last respects to this man. He says, nobody. He says, not a wife, not a father, not a mother, not a son, not a daughter, not a brother, not a sister, not a friend, not an acquaintance, not an employee, not an employer, not a relative, no one. And, you know, it said it kind of saddened him that there are people in his life that live X number of years and nobody could really give a rest behind when they're gone. That's sad, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah.
Okay. And we can ask ourselves, well, do we touch people in this life? I mean, when I say touch people, I don't mean pick their pocket. I mean, we touch them in a sense that, you know, we make a difference in their life. And that's what he's talking about here. A good name is to be more desired than a great wealth. But look at all, everybody's pursuing wealth. They're pursuing looking good on the outside. And God says favor is better than silver and gold. Another favor with God, favor with men. Then he says in that verse 2, he says, the rich and the poor have a common bond. The Lord is the maker of them all. That says a lot in this respect. Again, where do we put the emphasis on? We really do, because even God said it in Samuel. When he's talking to Samuel, he said, man judges by outward appearance, but God judges by the heart. And you look at here, the rich and the poor have a common bond. Well, what are we told? Paul tells us in Galatians that in Christ Jesus, man, there's neither slave nor free. There's neither Greek nor Jew. There's neither male nor female. I mean, we're one in God, one in Christ, right? And, you know, as far as God's concerned, he has no favorites in terms, and when I say favorites, in other words, he doesn't look at whether a man is well educated or he's powerful or he's influential or he's rich or, you know, famous, this type of thing. Before God, we're all equal. We're all reduced to zero in the sense that nobody has an advantage over another person. And what he's saying here is that God made them all, and they all have the same kind of value before God as far as their eternal value. And in verse 3 it says, the prudent see the evil and hides himself, but the naive go and are punished for it. Now I said the prudent person is a person with insight and discernment and understanding. You know, a prudent person, I mentioned before when Solomon talks about prudent person, a prudent person will look at a situation and say, what's going to be the consequences of this action? Because I've talked about this before. I mean, I cannot think of anything in life that does not have a consequence. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It's the same thing in a spiritual realm. It's the same thing. Everything has a consequence. I have wrecked my brain to think of something that does not have a consequence. Don't blink your eyes and it'll have a consequence. They will dry out and get infected. I mean, don't take a breath. That'll have a consequence. I mean, just throw it out there. I just can't not think of something that doesn't have a consequence. But it says here, the prudent sees evil and hides himself. He's going to look at something and say, what's the consequences of this going to be? And he says, the naive go on and are punished for it. You know, I don't know if you guys see this. This is in today's paper, Sacramento Bee. Anyway, it's this article in here. It just says, Pitt brings porn to UC Davis. It says, if all goes as planned, tonight hundreds of students at the University of California at Davis will watch a $10 million pornographic movie in the chemistry lecture hall, the periodic table of the elements hanging above their heads. And it says that they can go there. It's not going to cost them anything to go in and watch this $10 million pornographic movie. It says right here, but the larger point is to get young people accustomed to seeing adult movies as mainstream entertainment. All right. And students 18 and older can attend Pirates 2, which is the name of the movie, for free. UC Davis isn't charging, you know, for the room. And my point is this. All right. This is all being pushed on us in terms of, hey, this is acceptable. Pornography is acceptable. And here's the thing that I think a prudent person would say to himself. He'd look at this and say, you know what? I know what this is all about. You know, what they're trying to do, what this article said, is they're having some people get up some women get up and say, you know, we're showing this to show you that this could be an exploitation of women. And I just kind of laugh at this kind of flimsy, ridiculous, asinine kind of justification for this. You kind of cut through all the smoke screen and say, you know what it is? What it is? It's just a ploy of the devil to try to, you know, get more and more people involved in this. And it's a real weakness for men. So if you take a young kid, 18, 19, 20 years old, you know, he sits through this because everybody said, hey, this is the intelligent thing to do. This is the thing that's going to really make you sophisticated. But what it's really going to do is get men more and more involved in this industry, or, you know, become slaves to this. And they become basically serial adulterers. This is the world that pushes us on it. But when you read a verse like this, it says the prudent sees the evil and hides himself, but the naive go on and are punished. Now, you say, well, how would they be punished? Well, let me tell you something. If a person gets hooked on pornography, not only is he destroying his soul, but he's going to act this out. And there's a good chance that if he is really becomes more and more promiscuous, he can come down with a sexually transmitted disease. And if he comes down with that, especially if he comes down with HIV or comes down with AIDS, that's the end result of this kind of a behavior. And that's why it says here, but the naive go on and are punished for it. But the prudent person can say, you know what? God has a lot to say about this activity, and I'm not going to get involved with it. Because especially if you're a man, you're going to say to yourself, you know, I have a real weakness there, and I'm not going to put myself in that position. I'm not going to do it. Now, that's the prudent man. But like I said, the naive man will go ahead, and what's going to happen to him? He'll be punished for it. And the chances are, if he gets addicted in this area, it's going to cost him a lot of money to keep this addiction going. And it's going to cost him, you know, probably his marriage, probably his family, probably a lot of things. Because there are consequences to everything. Look at that verse 4. The reward of humility and fear of the Lord are riches, honor, and life. I mean, how many times have we read this or something similar to this? And I think it's very, very insightful, because it said the reward of humility and the fear of the Lord. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And how many times have I said going through this book, when we read verses similar to this, I've said wisdom and humility go hand in hand. You cannot have wisdom without humility. If you are a humble person, then you're a person who's able to take reproof, to take instruction, to take discipline, to take a rebuke. And you're going to look back and say, you know what, I appreciate the, you know, that comment, and I see the wisdom of your words, and I'm going to try to improve myself in this area. That's what it takes. But what happens is that the reward of humility and the fear of the Lord are riches, honor, and life. Anybody's Bible say long life? Okay, well, what happens if you are a wise person? A wise person, he's going to end up getting honor. He's going to end up getting riches. And he's going to have life. He's going to have life more abundantly because he's a wise person. But I've mentioned this before. A wise person very often will prolong his life in this world. And the reason he will prolong his life in this world is because he will be making all the right choices and making all the right decisions. He won't be doing stupid, idiotic things like, you know, going out there and racing his car down the street, or he won't be doing idiotic things, you know, that will throw him into the slammer or have him overdose on drugs or any number of things that can cut his life short. That's what it's talked about. The reward of humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life. And you're going to get honor. I hate to use myself as an example here, but last week I was asked to give a eulogy at a funeral. And the reason I guess I was asked is because I just got to know this guy, and I got to know his wife through my work. And, you know, they come in and I wait on him. I just got to know him. Long story short, I gave him some tapes to listen to. I've been witnessing to him. And anyway, he was dying. And I visited him a number of times on his deathbed, and I prayed over him for him. He never went to church, you know, never got involved with God. But I know that he really appreciated it. And I felt like God sent me there. And then when he died, you know, his wife ended up calling me and asked me if they didn't even know a pastor or anybody. So I went. I went to do the eulogy. And I gave the eulogy to the guy, and I said a prayer. And he had a lot of people there at his funeral. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was really shocked because I got so many praises for that. And I wasn't looking for it or anything like that. But I thought to myself when I read this verse, well, that's what happens when you try to honor God. You end up people honoring you for that type of thing. And like I said, I don't want to use myself as an example, but it kind of rang true for me when I read this of what happens when you really do try to let your light shine in such a way to glorify God, and, you know, they end up honoring you as well. In verse 5, it says, thorns and snares are in the way of the perverse. He who guards himself will be far from them. You know, thorns and snares are in the way of the perverse. Okay, a perverse person is a person who's going to turn things on their head. They're going to turn things around, and they're going to pervert them. They're going to turn things to the point where they're going to call good evil and evil good. And I'll just give you an example, because we're talking along these lines here. There's another article in this Newsweek magazine that deals with this epidemic of AIDS, that after 20-something, how many years has it been? Oh, this has been 30 years since this epidemic hit. And they haven't even got the first base in terms of a cure. This is killing millions upon millions of people worldwide. But not just that. There's so many other, you know, sexually transmitted diseases that are just epidemic, and they're pandemic. And people are dying by the millions, and they're coming down with all kinds of diseases. Well, if you read this, thorns and snares are in the way of the perverse. The perverse person is going to say, hey, you know what? Homosexual behavior is perfectly legitimate. And if you disagree with that, then you are a hateful bigot. Well, that's perverted. Because I've said before many times, hey, I don't care what your sexual orientation is. I don't. I personally do not care. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care if you want to marry your pet dog. It doesn't matter to me. But you got to look at what God has said at this. And if a person, or we take God's word and we pervert him, we say, hey, now God said this is wrong, but I'm telling you God's wrong. I'm telling you what is right. Well, you've just perverted something. And now, because you've perverted something, thorns and snares are in the way of the perverse. How many times I've talked about the consequences? And he says, he who guards himself will be far from them. In other words, this is the prudent person. He's going to look at the consequences. Anyway, so in verse 6, it says, train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, how many times have you read something like that? You got to train up a child in the way he should go. All right? But also, basically, we were talking earlier about where Solomon said that use the rod on the child, because the rod will keep the child out of hell, discipline the child. I remember a number of years ago, I don't know how long it's been, but it was quite a while back, and there was a situation where this father caught his 4-year-old son sniffing gasoline, and you know, he really reprimanded him for doing that, said, don't do that again. He caught him again doing it, and then he caught him again with his friend doing it, and the father slapped the kid. 4 years old. And, you know, somebody filed a complaint against him. He went before a judge. The judge gave him 4 years in prison with a commuted sentence of, he reduced his sentence to 2 years. And you got to ask, are we living in Alice in Wonderland? Are we living in an insane asylum? Are the inmates running the show here? How can you justify that? Now, I personally think the father should have used the rod on the kid and swatted him on the butt, okay? Because if you slap a kid, if you use your hand, it's showing a kind of contempt, a contemptuous spirit. But this is a father who's trying to save this kid's life. This kid was going to destroy his brain. This kid was going to, you know, kill himself. And this is what this judge did. And you wonder to yourself, where are we living? But it says, raise up a child, train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Well, here's a situation. You can train up a child the way he should go, but he may go wayward. And if he does, the chances are he will come back if he's trained up right. I think it's even Lenin who said something to the effect that, hey, give me the children until age 7, and the seed that I have planted will never be uprooted. Well, there's a lot of truth to that. You've got to train a child when he's young. Because by the time he hits the teenage, it's too late. The tree is already grown. It's already bent. And there's no straightening it out. It's always got to be while he's young, while he's a child. He says in verse 7, it says, the rich rule over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. Isn't that something? How many times have we read stuff like that? The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. I remember also listening to a Christian financial advisor a number of years ago on the radio. He was just giving a lot of wise advice about trying not to get into debt. Long story short, you know, he's raising up his young son, and his son, he wasn't a rebellious kid, but he just was kind of dense. I mean, he wasn't teachable. And he was always being very, he wasn't showing a lot of wisdom in terms of the way he would use his money. So anyway, long story short, he went to his dad one day and says, hey, Dad, can I borrow $30? His dad said, well, listen, I know that you know, you haven't paid me back in the past, but here's the thing I'll do. You want to borrow $30? Let's draw up a contract. And in this contract, we will have a payment schedule. I'll lend you $30, or you pay me back $10 a week. But you got to put something up for collateral. And he says, well, what's collateral? He says, well, it's something that's valuable to you that it will become mine if you don't pay me back. He says, okay. Well, he says, well, what do you have? So he put up his skateboard and he put up his stereo. Okay? And so they drew up their contract, and then the first week the kid paid him $10, and the second week the kid didn't pay him the $10. So dad went out and he took the skateboard and he sold it for $10. It was worth a lot more than that, but he sold it for $10. And the kid was livid. He was so angry. You had no right to sell that. He says, yes, I did. I had every right in the world because you didn't pay me and this belonged to me. And then so he didn't pay him another week. And so he sold his stereo for $10 to get his $30 back. And he said, you know, the kid was so angry about that, but he said he never asked to borrow money again. He learned a lesson here because he said the rich rule over the poor and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. Well, you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 28. God says this about his people. He said, if you forsake me and if you start living lives that are contrary to the way I have told you to live, he says all these curses are going to come upon you. And one of the curses is, says you will become the tail and not the head, and you will borrow and not lend. Well, when you read this, the rich rules over the poor and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. I mean, we're just becoming the slaves, right? We're the richest country on earth is now becoming dirt poor because we have forsaken God. But nobody sees the root cause. Nobody. They just keep saying, well, we'll just keep solving everything by throwing more and more money at it rather than saying, you know what? Go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 7, 14. But Solomon said that if my people who will call by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. That's the only thing that's going to heal this land. And verse 8, he says, he who sows iniquity will reap vanity, and the rod of his fury will perish. He who sows iniquity will reap vanity. Well, there we go. Reaping what you sow, all right? The consequence of reaping what you sow. If you sow iniquity, you're going to reap vanity. What's vanity? It's emptiness, it's futility, you're going to have absolutely nothing. He says, this is what you're going to sow. If you sow iniquity, you reap vanity. In other words, if you end up in prison, you've ruined your life. It's going to come to naught, right? Mm-hmm. He says here, and the rod of his fury will perish. The rod is used for instruction. The rod is used for discipline. The rod is used for correction. So when he says the rod of his fury, in other words, I think you could say that he's going to be ruined by the discipline that's going to come upon him because of his iniquity. He's just going to be ruined. That his iniquity is going to be used as a chastening rod to put an end to him. You see, I think that's what it's suggesting there. In verse 9, he says, he who is generous will be blessed, for he gives some of his food to the poor. He who is generous is blessed. Well, you know, that goes without saying, but have you guys seen this? This is today's paper, too. It's amazing. This is the message that right there above the fold. It says, a message rich in spirit, and they talked about the pastor preaches prosperity gospel. I won't even mention his name. Based upon giving. And it's a church here in the Sacramento area. And the whole emphasis is, hey, give us more money and you will be blessed. Give us more money and you will be blessed. Right here on our front cover, right above the fold, and you see all these people here, and they're giving testimonies about how they need to give more and more money. And, you know, I read this message, and I just can't help but look at this and say, what is this message lacking? It's called the prosperity gospel, right? That's what they call it. But what is the gospel?
Cross of Christ.
The gospel, yeah. The gospel is the good news that for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that those who believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. The problem with this is that when you get into this health, wealth, and prosperity type of church and type of preaching, type of belief, what's very, very often lacking is, hey, you know what? You know what's really needed here? What's really needed is repentance. What's really needed is to preach repenting of our sins and turning back to God and heaven and hell and judgment, this type of thing. But they're always emphasizing, especially because of the economy, you know, more and more people are falling into this trap saying, hey, man, just send us more money. But people think, well, if I send God $100, then he's going to bless me with $1,000. You know, this is the type of mindset that they begin to develop. And where is Christ in this? Where is the cross in this? Where is repentance in this? But you see, what one thing they've missed, and I've mentioned this like several times going through this book of Proverbs, is it always amazes me when I look at what God said in Deuteronomy chapter 15. He said this, however, there will be no poor among you, since the Lord will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess. He says, if only you listen obediently to the voice of your Lord your God and observe carefully all of his commandments which I command you today. See, this is being omitted in this prosperity gospel. the omission is this. God is saying this. There won't be any poor among you if you obey me. You see, this prosperity gospel is saying, hey, listen, you won't be poor if you give to me. You see? But God is saying, no, you won't be poor if you obey me. There wouldn't be any poor in this country. There wouldn't be any poor in the world if everybody obeyed God. And I think I even mentioned this maybe even last week. You just take the seventh commandment, thou shalt not steal. And if everybody in the world all of a sudden just kept that commandment, you know, from that here on out, just kept that commandment in the letter and in the spirit, inside of 30 days, this whole world would be turned on its ear overnight, and you would begin to see less and less poor upon this planet. You really would, just by simply obeying God. But where's that message? You don't see that message, do you? You just read stuff like preaching this message of, you know, send us more money and you'll be blessed. You know, I'm not trying to be these people's judge. I'm just simply saying, man, I think they're being sold a bill of goods. Because we really do need to say, hey man, what we really need to do is get right with God. All right.
I think another false message in that is that not only if you give 100 will you reap 1,000 from God, but if you think positively. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you must not have been thinking positively enough if you didn't get it.
Yeah,
you
know, right. The whole thing, it's just another twist on it. You're absolutely right. Good point. Because it's true. That the whole thing, positive thinking, or people, you know, they talk about the tongue, that you can create things with the tongue. I remember years ago going up to a retreat and listening to this guy talk about that. He came out with a book, talked about the tongue, and you can create everything with your tongue. And I'm sitting there, and as a pretty new Christian, I'm thinking, this is all bunk. This is all baloney. This isn't right. You know, this isn't right at all. But people fall for it. And they will go back to the book of Job. Look at all the hell that Job went through in his life. And they will look at a book like that and say, uh-huh. They will find the one verse in there where Job says, what I feared came upon me. And they say, see, he was a negative thinker. This is why this all happened to him. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with these people? Are they smoking dope? Have they read the story? They will torture things to get it to say clearly what it's not saying. And it says, drive out the scoffer and contention will go out. Even strife and dishonor will cease. Well, if you've got an assembly, especially in a church, where you've got a scoffer, a person who just is constantly stirring up muck and mire and ridiculing and putting down and tearing up, he's saying this, get rid of that person. Because what it says in Hebrews, it says, hey man, don't let any root of bitterness spring up among you, at least thereby many become defiled. This is what we need to do. This is what Paul did in the Corinthian church. I mean, there was a man there who basically was living in an incestuous relationship with his stepmother, and the church was just feeling like, well, we're all broad-minded, and we're very tolerant and everything. Paul said, get rid of the man. Get him out of your assembly right now. I want him out of there, because a little leaven leavens the whole lump. It's just going to ruin everything. And once they got the man out of there and he repented, then Paul says, okay, he's repented, now bring him back in. And it says in verse 11, it says, he who loves purity of heart and whose speech is gracious, the king is his friend. He who loves purity of heart. You know what Jesus said? Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God, right? What does it mean to be pure of heart?
Singleness of mind.
Yeah. In other words, the purity of heart, he's not talking about moral purity in this sense. He's talking about a person whose heart is pure towards God. In other words, they got their focus on God. They got their focus on God. They got a purity of vision. And these type of people are going to see God because their focus is on God, right? It's not on the things of the world. That's the purity of heart. And whose speech is gracious? The king is his friend. Well, you could apply this even for, you know, on your job, to your employer, but apply it to Christ. The king is your friend. That's what it really is pointing to, spiritually speaking. But apply it to your job, for example. If you're in a situation where you have a purity of heart, you're an honest, trustworthy person your employee can depend upon, and whose speech is gracious, the king is your friend. In other words, he's going to appreciate you, right? And verse 12 says, the eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge, but he overthrows the words of the treacherous man. It says, the eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge, but he overthrows the words of the treacherous man. Now, you've got to ask yourself, okay, break this down. The eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge. Now, how does that preserve knowledge, the eyes of a God? If you go back to Psalm 34, in the King James Version, God says this, I will guide thee with my eye. When God says, I will guide thee with my eye, the suggestion is we have to be looking into God's eyes in order to be guided, in order to be directed. And how many times have I said, going through this book, Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. Well, here's what happens. When we cut our focus on God, we become a knowledgeable person. Because you go back to Isaiah chapter 11, there lists the seven spirits of God: the spirit of the Lord, spirit of wisdom, spirit of knowledge, spirit of understanding, spirit of counsel, the spirit of might, spirit of the fear of the Lord. And like I said, one of the spirits is that of knowledge. But Paul says, in the last days, men will be forever learning, but never come to the knowledge of the truth. People can accumulate a lot of facts, but that's not the knowledge we're talking about here. The knowledge we're talking about is the knowledge of God. What life is all about. What's going to happen to him after he dies? I mean, he's going to look at life and have a knowledge that most people don't have. Why? Because he's got his eyes and his focus on God. But when he says here, he overthrows the words of the treacherous man. I mean, to me, one of the biggest treacherous things that have been perpetrated upon mankind is this whole Darwin evolution. It just is. And when I was reading about this treacherousness here, I couldn't help but thinking, because I got Darwin's book here, The Origin of Species. But do you know what the real title of this book is? The real title, they hide it in here. The real title is The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. This is a very, very racist book, because Darwin was suggesting certain races are superior to other races.
Yeah, that's selecting what's going to live.
Right.
Well, you're I think it goes further than that, kind of like Hitler.
Exactly.
If you had a defect of any kind or whatever, you
exactly.
Go to the bottom of the...
Right.
Exactly. That's very good, because I was going to bring up Hitler as an example. But I'm reading this verse here. It says, the eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge. If you've got your eyes on God, you're going to know the facts. You're going to know the truth, right? But he overthrows the words of the treacherous man. This is treachery, as far as I'm concerned. It really is. And in verse 13, it says, the sluggard says there's a lion outside. I will be killed in the streets. You know, how many times have God mentioned sluggards or the slothful person? God has a lot to say about these people. But when he says here, the sluggard says there's a lion outside... In other words, the lazy, slothful person is always going to come up with some lame, ridiculous excuse of why he can't get out of bed and go to work. And he says here, I will be killed in the streets. In other words, even if there is a danger, let's just say this slugger says, well, you know, it's kind of raining outside. I don't want to get in my car and go to work because I might get in an accident. Well, even if there is a slight danger, he will always exaggerate the danger. The real problem is he's a slothful, lazy person. But take this to the spiritual level now and just apply it spiritually. The slugger says there's a lion outside. I will be killed in the streets. In other words, how many people are spiritual sluggers? They're just lazy. In other words, oh, I can't go to church today. It's drizzling outside. But if it was a blizzard outside and they want to go to Reno, they'd go. It's always exaggerated. But it always comes down to a matter of priorities. And in verse 14, it says, the mouth of an adulteress is a deep pit. He who is cursed of the Lord will fall into it. That's interesting, the mouth of an adulteress. Why didn't he just say an adulteress is a deep pit? Why does he say the mouth of an adulteress is a deep pit? He who is cursed of the Lord will fall into it.
Because that's what she uses to entice.
Good. What is it about the mouth of a woman that can really entice a man? I'm not talking about her body. I'm talking about what is it about the mouth of a woman that really, really preys upon a weakness of a man?
Respect, praise.
There it is. Admiration, praise. You know, this really goes, this intoxicates a man. It'll intoxicate a man. It really will intoxicate a man. And, you know, if he's not getting much praise at home, but just criticism and whatever, and a woman just praises and praises, you know what? It's a deep pit for a man. It really is. He can fall in this and never get out. That's what he's talking about. The mouth of an adulteress is a deep pit. He who is cursed, the Lord will fall into it. Well, if a man's not going to put his priorities right, he can fall into this easily. And, you know, so many marriages have just come to ruin because of it. That's what he's talking about. And verse 15 says, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from it. You know, if you tie it up with that verse 6, train up a child in the way he should go, even when he is old, he will not depart from it. And then you look at this verse 15, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from him. In other words, a child, as foolishness is bound up there, they're just going to do stupid, idiotic, immature, ridiculous things. And they have to be, you know, trained. They have to be, it says here, the rod of discipline will remove it far from. They can do things that are going to, you know, that are some of the most foolish, idiotic things.
It doesn't always take a physical a spanking.
Right.
You know, like with Nicholas, when he was younger, and even still, I just raised my voice, and he, I could tell that he's affected by that. He doesn't want to displease.
Right.
So I to be careful. Yes. Just a raise of the voice, and he was sensitive to that.
Yeah. I think that's very wise. My dad told me that having seven kids, with each one of the kids, that discipline was different with them, because some, he said, a tone in a voice or a look would do it, and others needed the spanking.
Yeah. Well, what are we reading an earlier proverb where Solomon says, a rebuke to a wise man will go deeper than 100 blows to the back of a fool. And Nicholas is a wise little kid, you know. So a little rebuke to him goes much deeper than 100 blows to the back of a fool. But, I mean, look at some of the stupid, idiotic things that a kid will do. I mean, a kid will, you know, get in there and start playing with rat poison and start eating it. And this is a fool, stupid thing. And a rod will straighten him out real quick. I mean, you can just throw it out there. A kid will do just any number of things to endanger his life. All right, he's in the closet playing with matches. Now, what are you going to do? Oh, Dr. Spock says go in there and just blow out the match and say, well, let's just sing happy birthday, and you know what I'm saying? Yeah, see? She'll tell you, right?
I did. I hid in the closet so I wouldn't be found.
When you were playing matches?
My mom smelled the sulfur. And yes, I got beat within an inch of my life.
Well, see? That, why? Because what does it say here? Foolish, this is bound up in the heart of a child. Was that foolish? Was that foolish?
But I didn't know it. I was trying to... I was watching the ends of the match burn.
Right. But that's what I say. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. You know, they won't do it again if they can't sit down for a week. I guarantee it. And verse 16 says, he who oppresses the poor to make more for himself, or he who gives to the rich will only come to poverty. That says a lot, too. He who oppresses the poor to make more for himself, in other words, exploit the poor. He's just doing this to God. But why would you want to give to the rich? This is what, you know what, that was another article that was out there on Sunday's paper. They just showed you about how all these lobbyists just keep putting more and more money in the coffers of these politicians, and all it is bribe money. It will come to poverty. In other words, bribe the cop, bribe the politician, bribe the people in authority. And the more they take bribes, the more you can control. And once the criminal, once the mob takes over, then you're going to come to poverty yourself. And verse 17, incline your ear. Matter of fact, when we read this verse 17, what we really need to do is read through verse 21, because the whole thing goes together. It says, incline your ear and hear the words of the wise and apply your mind to my knowledge. For it will be pleasant if you keep them within you, that they may be ready on your lips, so that your trust may be in the Lord. I have taught you today, even you. Have I not written to you excellent things of counsels and knowledge, to make you know the certainty of the words of truth, that you may correctly answer him who sent you? If you read this together, because it all applies, this is God speaking. He says, incline your ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply your mind to knowledge. Now, this is something that's up to us. Incline your ear and hear the words of the wise. In other words, how many times have I said it going through this book? To me, there's probably no better place that we could gain wisdom than sitting around and reading God's word and taking it really serious. Because wisdom comes from God. That's all there is to it. As a matter of fact, when we went through the book of Job, this is what Job says about wisdom. He said this. He said, surely there is a mine of silver and a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust and copper is smelted from rock. Man puts an end to darkness, and to the farthest limits he searches out the rock in gloom and deep shadow. He sinks a shaft far from habitation, forgotten by the foot. They hang and swing to and fro, far from men. The earth, from it comes food, and underneath it is turned up as fire. Its rocks are a source of sapphires, and its dust contain gold. The path of no bird of prey knows, nor has the falcon's eye caught sight of it. The proud beasts have not trodden it, nor has the fierce iron passed over it. He puts his hand on the flint, and he overturns the mountains at the base. He hewns out channels through the rock, and his eye sees anything precious. He dams up the stream to the from flowing, and what is hidden he brings out into light. But where can wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living, or found on earth. The deep says, it is not with me, in other words, the sea. The sea says, it is not with me. Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed out as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, its precious onyx or sapphire. Gold or glass cannot equal it. It says, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. And then it just, we know what it's just going on and saying here. He's saying this. He's saying that men have dug all kinds of mines, have gone deep, deep down into the earth, you know, where no animal has ever gone, no bird has ever seen, and they dig out, what, precious stones and gold and silver and all of these things. You know, they search for gold. But he says this. They search for all this precious metal and all these precious golds, but they will never find wisdom. Because wisdom cannot be found on earth. Wisdom comes from God. But God is saying, if you search for wisdom, as men have searched for gold and for silver and precious stones, you will really find it. But you see, it has to be an effort on our part. I just can't believe that people can just sit in front of the TV 58 hours a week and think they're going to have any wisdom in their life, because it's just not. But that's what he's talking about here when he says here, God's word, he said, verse 18, it will be pleasant if you keep them within you, that they may be ready on your lips. In other words, if we have wisdom, we're going to be able to give an apt answer, so that your trust may be in the Lord, and I have taught you today, even you. We put our trust in God, we're going to have this wisdom, because wisdom's going to teach us. He says, have I not written to you excellent things of counsels and knowledge? In other words, this is God's writing to us, and they're excellent things. We're going to be able to see things that other people can't see. He says, to make you know the certainty of the words of truth, that you may correctly answer him who sent you. Like I said, you know, with wisdom, you're going to be able to have an apt answer. With wisdom, you're going to be able to see through things. With wisdom, you're going to know what life is all about, where you're going, what's going to happen to you after you die, where did you come from. You're going to be able to answer the really important questions. And verse 22, it says, do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate. Well, you know, when he says crush the afflicted at the gate was the place where the judges used to gather together. All right. So basically, you could just change that to courts. All right. Because read 22 and 23 together. It says, do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their case and take the life of those who rob them. In other words, these judges have tremendous responsibility before God to mete out justice. But look at how much of today's justice has been perverted. It just has. Right? It just has. I mean, I'll give you an example, even though people just hate me for it. It says, do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate. Look at what's happened at the gate, at our Supreme Court. Our Supreme Court decided that, hey, an unborn child is just subhuman. We can just get rid of it. All right? Well, we were talking earlier about Hitler, and we're talking about Darwinism and how Hitler took off on Darwinism about the super race, and then he began to implement that, the survival of the fittest, and by natural selection he started doing away with all what he referred to as useless eaters. Well, look what we are doing now. So when you look at this in verse 22, do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their case and take the life of those who rob them. I'm just reading this and I can see that God's going to plead their case. In verse 24 says, do not associate with a man given to anger, or to go with a hot-tempered man, or you will learn his ways and find a snare for yourself. Now, he said this several different times, but how many guys are in prison today because they hooked up with the wrong person? Right? He says, don't associate with a man given to anger, or go with a hot-tempered man, or you will learn his ways and find a snare for yourself. I mean, it's just a fact of life. I mean, Paul tells us, he says, hey, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, he says, hey, man, bad company corrupts good morals. It's going to destroy you if you hang around the wrong person. Hang around with a hot-tempered man. The hot-tempered man, he may pull a gun and start shooting people if he gets angry, and you're standing there with him, and next thing you know, you're an accomplice. In verse 26, he says, do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debts. And you know, how many times has he said that? It's just wise, sound financial advice. Don't co-sign for other people. Don't be a guarantee for other people's debts and that type of thing, because it's going to bring you to ruin. That's what he's saying. And in verse 27, it says, if you have nothing with which to pay, why should you take your bed from under you? I was talking about, we should have read those two verses together. It says, do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should you take your bed from under you? Why should you take your bed from under you? I was talking about that kid, you know, and that financial planner who took away his skateboard and he took away his stereo. But this says take away your bed. So what's the implication? If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take your bed from under you?
Mortgage your house.
Yeah, he's going to take your home from you. You know, the place you sleep, your dwelling place, right? You're going to lose it all. That's what Solomon says. Don't do that.
It goes right back to
22:7.
Yeah, exactly.
The borrower is servant to the leader.
Yeah, right. Okay, in verse 28 it says, do not move the ancient boundaries which your fathers have set. That says in Deuteronomy 19:14. We read that again and again. God said, don't remove this ancient boundaries. And God had meted out territory for each tribe and for each family, for each clan, and that was their territory. It was determined by lot. Well, if a person had a creek running through their property and their neighbor said, man, I really want that creek. So he just takes his neighbor's boundary mark, whether it was a monument, whether it was a pole or whatever it was, he moved it back so he could have it. Well, that's just flat out being dishonest and stealing and cheating, right? And we have to be honest. We have to be honest in all of our dealings. You know, in verse 29, it says, do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. A man skilled in his work. He's talking about a man who's really diligent in his work. I don't care what kind of work it is. If he's really diligent, he says he will stand before kings. In other words, he's going to get a promotion or apply to our relationship with God, right? We're going to stand before God someday. And if we really are striving and doing our utmost and making a really, truly honest effort to do what? Love God with our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. And love our neighbor as ourselves. Well, that's a man who's going to stand before kings. And he will not stand before obscure men. In other words, he's going to be honored before the mighty. All right, he's going to be promoted. He's going to be recognized before, you know, the rich and the famous to the powerful. Anybody have anyone to add or share?